Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. This is the final episode of this season, the final episode of the Arnold Podcast 2022. And we have the Podfather, Craig Cohen. It's quite a coup, I can tell you. As always, I am here with Doug Greenberg, and we are talking the greatest Arnold movie ever, Total Recall. Craig, thank you so much for joining.
Oh, thank you, Seiko. I never need an excuse to rewatch Total Recall, but it had been a while since I'd watched it. And man, I was equal parts ecstatic and angry while watching it. We can get into that once we start really talking. But I love talking with you. I love talking with Doug. I love the network. So I'm excited to be here. And I can't wait to have this discussion.
Yeah, this is Arnold at his best. This is Verhoeven at his best. This, I mean, you, and it took the route that it took to get what we have on screen is the backstory for this is amazing in itself. But what we have, what we actually walk away with is it's this movie brilliance, cinematic brilliance.
And this is Arnold's baby. He knew this was going to be successful. He knew the script was going to work. He found it in Dino De Laurentiis' catacombs. Dino had been trying to make this for like half a decade. He tried it with James Caan. He tried it with Patrick Swayze in Australia. I think he went bankrupt trying to make this. So Arnold knew the script was floating around somewhere. And of course, he'd had a couple of near misses with The Running Man and with Red Heat. But he did have his producer connection with Red Heat, the guys from Carolco, the guys who produced Rambo 3. So when he finally got a way into the script, he called Andrew Vanya and he said, listen, you have to get the script. You just have to get it. Dino De Laurentiis has gone bankrupt. This is our shot. Apparently, Mario Casar called Dino. They cinched the deal in minutes. They had this script in a couple of hours. And this movie was greenlit in a weekend. That's power of Arnold at his peak.
That's amazing. And you said it a couple of times, and it really goes all back to this script. And if you mm-hmm. look at the pedigree and the people involved with that script, those are writers, man. And yeah. That was one of the things that sort of angered me while watching this movie is that, like, I don't think there's I don't know if it's a pride or just a skill set, but man, those dudes knew how to write. And I just think that's one of the main ingredients that's missing in Hollywood today is the scripts. They start with a shitty script. And once you start with a shitty script, it doesn't matter how hard you all try. If the words on the page suck, you're just not going to get a good movie.
Well, Philip K. Dick, that sounds like a nom de guerre to me. That sounds like someone who was blacklisted and managed to find a way into publishing anyway. So yeah. You wrote this story called We Can Remember It For You Wholesale. Did you cover this on your book podcast?
No, but it was on my long list of things I wanted to cover. Mm-hmm. I'm a big Philip K. Dick fan. For people listening, they probably know his work more than they know him. He wrote a novel that was the inspiration for Blade Runner. He did a story that they turned into a Peter Weller movie called... what was that called? Second Variety, maybe. But either way, he's made. There's probably been a Scanner Darkly, the Keanu Reeves animated movie was Philip K. Dick.
Right.
Hollywood has sort of picked the bones of Philip K. Dick, and they've rarely made a successful adaptation. And while Total Recall isn't a great adaptation of We Can Remember It For You Wholesale, it captured the vibe of Philip K. Dick, which is the most important thing to do. If you're not going to hit every story beat, you hit the vibe of what is reality, what's real, what's not, who's out to get me. Philip K. Dick was a true paranoid dude, and that transferred to his work, and that transfers to this movie, because I was so impressed by the ability the screenwriters had to sort of juggle a lot of things in this movie.
Oh, this movie is on acid. Let's face facts.
Yeah, the one difference between Philip K. Dick's short story, which if I remember, it's about 30 pages, mm-hmm. which is it's perfect. It's better to adapt a short story than a novel.
I agree.
Because then you get all these Stephen King monstrosities. Mm. But the main difference is in the short story, he never leaves Earth.
Right.
Mars is referenced, but he never actually leaves Earth. And in this movie, of course, they go to Mars, and thank God.
I also feel like, you know, in too many movies about the future, the futuristic view of America is like this gleaming white, squeaky clean, you know, everything's sanitized. But in this and in Blade Runner, you get this, like, it's not as nice as people predict. It's like gritty, it's grimy, you know, it's kind of like a hellscape. Lived in, for sure.
And that's the Paul Verhoeven influence there as well, because he is a filmmaker that we didn't deserve, but thank God we got him.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I grew up with that guy, so lucky me, so, I guess.
No, so Seiko, how was that? Like, I'd imagine, like, for most people, Verhoeven didn't come onto their radar until maybe Flesh and Blood, but for a lot of people, myself included, it was RoboCop.
Yeah.
Like, so being aware of him as a filmmaker prior to RoboCop, what was that like? I mean, did you have any sort of expectations going in, or you sort of were in on the joke and knew what you were going to get with RoboCop?
Definitely in on the joke. Yeah. Here's the thing. Paul Verhoeven was in on the nucleus. I mean, in the 60s, there was no film industry in Holland. He pretty much helped build it. So here's a guy who he went to college to become a mathematician. And his parents wanted him to become a professor, really. And he wasn't having it because he was pure child of the 60s. So he ended up in the army, and he ended up in the publicity part of the army. So he made some, I actually seen this movie, a documentary on the Dutch Marines, which is the oldest Marine naval force in the world. And so he made like this propaganda film on that. And that's basically what that was, his ticket in to making features. And his first feature, which is famous and earned a lot of awards, is Turkish Fruit. And Turkish Fruit is based on the novel by Jan Wolkers, which is a literary masterpiece. It's a disgusting, awful book to read, but it is a masterpiece. And it's basically about a tragic love affair. And that movie is seminal for him because it made him the filmmaker that he is, because Jan Wolkers was very daring and he was very outspoken and he was very controversial. And Paul Verhoeven actually wasn't. He's just a mathematician, but he learned so much from making that project and from the reactions that it garnered. Because basically the stuff you guys got in Basic Instinct and in Showgirls and in other stuff he did, he was doing that in 1973. So all that stuff that came later, that was all par for the course for us. The stuff you would see in L or in Starship Troopers, that was already in Soldier of Orange. That was already in Flesh and Blood. And I grew up on that stuff.
Mm-hmm. The one thing I really appreciate about Paul Verhoeven, and he's probably in my top five favorite directors of all time, is that for Oven, it's all about the overall production design and feel of the movie and the performances. You're never going to see a crazy technical shot in one of his movies and say, oh my God, that shot's crazy. What an amazing shot. I mean, his movies all look great. And there's some cool shots in Total Recall, but none of it's showy, none of it's flashy. It's all about the production design, the feel of the universe, and his performances. And that was one thing I really noticed in this movie, is that every performance is perfect. And if you've ever seen footage of Verhoeven on set or behind the scenes, you'll see what kind of director he is.
Yeah, he's insane. He's completely insane. He is a nutty professor.
Yeah, I mean, he was working with some great talent in this film, don't get me wrong, but I think, you know, his ability to sort of, you know, nurture a performance out of somebody is one of his greatest strengths. And I'm glad he came to Hollywood, did what he needed to do, and I'm glad he went home and is making the films he wants to make, because Hollywood sure tried to kick his butt.
Yeah, he actually still lives in LA.
Oh, does he?
But he's making movies in France now.
Yeah.
He actually made L, which is a critically acclaimed film that actually earned him a Golden Globe. I can recommend it because it's typically Verhoeven. I think it's the closest thing to the movie he made in the early 80s, which was called The Fourth Man. The story of L is about a woman who is violently raped, but instead of playing the victim card, she enters into a relationship with her rapist and tries to dominate him. It's a really, really crazy movie. It's worth a watch simply because of the way he directed the actress, because he realized what a talent this woman was, and he just unleashed her. And like you said, this is a director who is good at bringing out talent in people. He's good at seeing it in people. He's good at bringing it out. And that's what you see in Arnold. He brings out arguably the best performance of his career, because Arnold actually was awarded best actor for this movie. And he got a Saturn Award for it, which is a science fiction award. It's very prestigious. And this is a guy who normally gets Razzie nominations. So it just depends on who's directing him. Because Arnold is a guy that, you know, he's logical. So if you give him a clear direction, he's going to succeed.
You mentioned the performances. There's like 2 points I want to make here about the performance and about getting the most out of Arnold. I actually saw Doug Quaid and Hauser as two different people, even though they're played by the same actor, because he plays them so completely differently. And, you know, for a guy who's not classically trained like Arnold, that's like an amazing performance that the director is able to get out of him.
Yes.
And also, if you look back at the old horror movies, the Friday the 13th and everything, they sacrifice performances for graphic violence and everything. Mm-hmm. But it seems like Verhoeven gets the best of both worlds. Like he has, you could call this a horror movie based on just the graphic nature of like the prosthetics and the makeup and everything. And, he's just the master of the squid explosion,
Paul Verhoeven fights for the violence in his movies because he feels it's absolutely essential to telling the story. Same with sex.
But he doesn't sacrifice performances for that is what I'm saying.
True.
You know, it's the best of both worlds.
Yeah. Basically he takes everything and just amps it up to 10.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. There's actually a funny story, I believe, about RoboCop, where he had a lot of problems with the violence on RoboCop. And one scene in particular was the scene where Ed 209 kills that executive in the office.
Right.
And originally it was much shorter. And everybody in the room felt uncomfortable with it. Mm-hmm. So but then he made that scene longer, so it almost becomes comical.
Right. Yeah.
You know, but you're watching this extreme violence, but at the same time, it's so absurd. It's like a cartoon almost. And I think that's another one of the things that he's really smart with is he's like, violence is terrible and it's absurd. And at the same time, we shouldn't turn away from it. And it's funny, my wife was in and out of the room when I was watching this last night, and like she caught a couple of the scenes that have like that extreme violence in it, like, you know, where Arnold's breaking out of the chair. And like she was just amazed. Like it had been years since she had seen it. And she was like, oh, my God, this is really violent.
Yeah. I'm way ahead of its time.
Yeah. One other thing I do want to say, Seiko, is you mentioned the Saturn Awards. And I think the involvement with Dan O'Bannon and Ronald Shusett probably have a lot to do with the goodwill this movie got in the science fiction community, because those guys, I believe their origins date back to Ridley Scott's Alien.
That's probably why they got like best science fiction film. And I think they got best costumes and they were nominated for all kinds of stuff.
They're also
nominated for the Oscars. I mean, this was an Oscar nominated movie. Yeah. It got best effects. I think it had like a special achievement award, which is not typical for the Oscars.
Yeah. Well, you had a brilliant Rob Bottin doing a lot of the makeup effects.
Mm.
And I think a lot of people probably know Rob Bottin from The Thing and all of the amazing practical effects he did on The Thing that 40 years later still stand up better
than one of the scariest movies of all time.
Yeah.
An absolute masterpiece.
But I think the effects work in this movie is great. And even like a lot of the stuff that I was worried about, like the seam showing on, like particularly like a lot of the Mars centric stuff, it looked good. I mean, you could tell there were certain models at play in, at points. But overall, I think this movie, from a visual standpoint,
it still stands up.
It aged extremely, extremely well. And it was also cool that I a lot of those locations on Earth, it was Mexico City.
Right.
And that train station.
If you've been there, you recognize certain places.
But yeah, you know, but it's so wild because I was thinking about that. I'm like, yeah, this looks cool for like the average U.S. American viewer. But if you live in Mexico City, you're like, oh, what's he doing at the Metro?
Right. I've been to that mall. I recognized like certain parts of the airport. I was like, oh, I was just there. It's amazing.
I would say the only wonky scenes were like the rear projection stuff of the Mars landscapes and whatever. Yeah. But I think that could be tightened up these days, you know.
I mean, these days they would have done everything CGI. The irony here is this was one of the first movies that actually used CGI, and Paul Verhoeven is actually one of the pioneers of CGI movies. I mean, Starship Troopers is the first real movie using realistic CGI.
Well, and so that's Phil Tippett, who is just a genius in his own right. One thing that you talked about tightening things up, and I know you didn't mean it in that way, Doug, but another thing that struck me about this movie is that if they made this movie today, and I know they made that Colin Farrell remake, but we're not going to talk about that. If they made this movie today, what they do in the first 20 minutes of this movie would take 45 minutes today. I mean, this movie has, it's an Arnold movie. So, you know, there's not going to be a lot of fat involved, but this movie has like no fat on the bones. I mean, it hits the ground running. He has his dream. He wakes up, he decides he wants to go to, you know, to Mars or whatever. And he goes to recall. And again, like I said, in this movie, they're like, let's get to it. Whereas, and I think that's another thing that films today suffer from, is they set up too much time building a world that they're not going to explore anyway. Where here, they create the world really quick. You fill in the blanks in your head, and they get going. And that's another thing that I think the writers are talented enough to realize that the audience is going to be smart enough to follow. And Verhoeven, too. He's not a pandering filmmaker. He's not going to spoon feed you. So it's like, this is what we're doing. Let's go.
And if you hire Paul Verhoeven, you unleash him.
It's still a 2-hour film, too. But it doesn't feel like 2 hours. No. And B, if like the classic 80s action films were 87 to 93 minutes long, you never saw a 2-hour film like this. But it's like Craig said, there's no fat in it. Like, what do you cut out that would benefit the movie in any way?
Impossible.
All right, impossible. So 2 hours.
Everything
is
essential to the plot, and this is a thick plot. This is a movie you have to pay attention to, and that's one of the things that makes it so rewatchable. Because the fun part of this movie is you can watch it in two ways, because it's inspired on Hitchcock, and so what you're watching is either it's an action movie from the perspective of Arnold, who's doing action shit and being a hero. Or this is a guy who goes to some place and gets his brain messed up and is basically going through psychosis and is going to be lobotomized after the last scene. Because Paul Verhoeven purposely planted that in the movie.
And they leave it ambiguous enough. Even at the end, they don't explain it. They leave it up to the viewer.
And there are like two pivotal scenes where Verhoeven basically just tells you the plot of the next 20 minutes. It's like at the scene where he's like getting his implant, they're just showing you, it's like, oh, he's going to have this girl and he's going to be a secret agent and this is going to happen and that is going to happen. And at the end of the day, we're not going to spoil it for you. So, and then the second scene, you have the point where Recall intervenes, where they send a professor in and saying, hey, look, I'm sorry, but you're going through a delusion and here's your wife and please take this pill, which is, by the way, this is like pre-Matrix. This is like the Matrix pretty much based their idea of like the red pill and the blue pill on this movie. It's like, take this pill and you come back to reality. And if you don't take this pill, you're just going to end up lobotomized. And here's the thing. Does Quaid invent the idea that this professor is bullshitting him, so he shoots him in the head so he can be the hero in his secret agent fantasy? Or are these people trying to trick him? Is this a secret agent posing as his ex-wife or his wife who he now has to fight? I mean, it's such a mindfuck, this entire movie, and you don't get a straight answer at all. You can do anything you want with this movie.
Yeah, but the other thing that's really, really good is it's not super confusing, which, you know, I mean, well, I mean, if you start thinking about it too much and you start peeling away the layers of the onion, you can probably get yourself cross-eyed. But what I'm saying is a casual viewer, the average moviegoer in 1990, is able going to just be able to follow this beat by beat as an action movie, like you said, but they don't have to get too invested in the hows and the whys. And I think, again, some filmmakers today try to like outsmart themselves and outsmart the audience and just make things confusing for the sake of making them confusing.
As a, you know, a 12, 13 year old watching this, I didn't care about the story. I was confused. I didn't know what the hell was going on plot wise, but I loved it because of the action. And now here as a, you know, 44 year old guy, I love the action, obviously, but I also I'm invested in the story behind it.
Yeah. And you don't have to be embarrassed that you still love this movie because it is absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the second coming of Hitchcock in every scene. I mean, there's this one specific scene where Verhoeven actually films the scene as if it was a Hitchcock scene. You know, with those low angles where you shoot the bad guy who is doing sinister shit from the low perspective, and you shoot the hero from another perspective to tell the audience, guess what's happening? This is bad.
And yeah, they do that without
just so good at that.
They do that without spoon feeding the audience. Exactly. You know, they use clever tricks and everything. I hate, and Craig, I've mentioned it many times in our shows, how the stupid audience just needs to be spoon fed and told what to feel instead of just using psychology, you know,
cheap gimmicks.
Yeah. But, but you get all that without being spoon fed. And that's, it's a lost art in movies these days.
Yes, that's what I like so much about the Benny character, because he is everywhere. He's one of those guys who guides the plot along, and he starts out as an ambiguous character, and then you start to like him. You know, he does cool stuff, and you think, oh, he's a mutant too, and he's a hero, and then he turns out he's an agent like that, just like everyone else. Yeah. He can't be trusted, and it's a complete bait and switch.
He's great because he's like comic relief. He's comic relief at first, and then like his character shifts, you know, into like a double agent. Like how did a guy like Benny, like a throwaway character, come to play such a pivotal part?
Exactly. He's not just a plot device. He's a complex character. Yeah. And the actor knew about this, and he made exactly the right choices. So you would be rooting for him in one scene, and you would be wondering about him in the next. I mean, without Benny, they would never have caught Quato.
I'm sorry, I forgot the actor's name, but when he first saw the description of his character, he's a black exploitation actor. So he saw his character was going to be a fast talking, jive talking black guy, and he threw the script across the room and said, "Fuck this! Not another one of these films. Mm-hmm. Then when he picked up the script and actually read it, he fell in love with the movie and with the character.
Inevitably, because he's
more than just
ever going to play.
Yeah, and his character is so much more than a jive talking black guy.
Mel Johnson Jr., by the way, and he's from Long Island City.
No kidding.
From your neck Queens of the woods, boy. Or your old neck of the woods, we should say. You're living in sunny Las Vegas now.
Sweltering Las Vegas.
Yeah. So then we have this awesome score. And because we're dealing with Caracol here, so we're going to get Goldsmith. And it's one of his best scores. It's so incredibly beautiful. And what I love about the movie starts, and you hear the typical Goldsmith dramatic overture, but you also hear a little bit of the Schwarzenegger with the Conan music, with the Terminator. It's very inspired. It's basically Goldsmith saying, "I've moved on from Stallone. I'm a Schwarzenegger guy now."
Jerry Goldsmith is a genius. He doesn't get he doesn't get John Williams props or Hans Zimmer props, but he really should.
He should.
Maybe it's because like most of the films that he's scored are like these action movies from the early days. But I mean, the scores mean as much to these movies as like a sweeping epic by Hans Zimmer.
I think the reality is 200 years from now or 300 years from now, when historians and cultural critics look back at this age, they will start looking at the movies that were popular, and they're going to be seeing the action movies, not Terms of Endearment.
Right.
Not anything else. And they'll be hearing Jerry Goldsmith's score, not anything else. So they're going to automatically assume how important he was to our culture. I think that's the bottom line. How are you going to be remembered? You're going to be remembered by the success you were involved in and by how many people you reached and how effective your artwork was.
He loves doing these films. Like he said, this is one of his favorite scores, and it's not, and he said, it's not the kind of score that you walk out of the theater whistling the motif. He said, it's just something, it's a score that just perfectly sets the tone, the background for the movie. And like, it's one of his favorite scores, and I wouldn't disagree with him.
Because he had to challenge himself, because this is an action movie. This is a science fiction epic. This is a critique on culture in many ways. So this encompasses a lot of themes, and that all has to be represented by the movie and score in the music, by the score.
I mentioned spoon-feeding audiences. Music and score is another thing that another tool that they use to tell the dummy audience what to feel. But I mean, it wasn't the case back then, you know. It just set the tone. It set the background. It like brought you into the action of the scene, how desperate the scene is, the action in it, you know. It slows down when you need to take a step back and breathe. Like, a score really tells a lot about.
Yeah. Well, and Jerry Goldsmith was an absolute master. And he probably had one of the biggest toolboxes out of every composer that was working at that time. He was not limited by his ability to get bogged down by just doing straight orchestrations. You listen to some of his scores and they're very percussive and they're very rhythm driven. And then you listen to a score like LA Confidential, which just really leaned into like, okay, this is a movie in the 50s. It's going to sound like the 50s.
Yes. Let's make a film noir.
Yeah. And, you know, the great thing about Goldsmith is you can tell it's Goldsmith, but at the same time, so many movies, the score is so different than anything he's ever done. It's weird that he's got this uniqueness, but at the same time, he's able to speak in a wide variety of musical languages.
Yes, he's a true artist. And it's amazing to me that when you bring so much talent together for a movie like this, and this was the second most expensive movie to date, because the only movie more expensive, also produced by Carolco, was Rambo 3. And that didn't have remotely the kind of talent this movie had. You're always running a risk of going off the rails and not being able to please all the egos. This just came together, and this just, something greater came out of this.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Carolco wasn't, they weren't a monster in the production industry either, were they?
Well, not at the start, but after Rambo 3, it's whenever you saw TriStar and whenever you saw that horse coming and whenever you saw that Carolco C on the screen, you know you were in for it. You know this was going to be a great movie.
How did you guys, that brings me to a point. How did you guys watch this?
On my laptop on HBO Max.
Okay, I watched it on HBO. Okay. Well, I mean, did you put a Blu-ray or a DVD in? Or
Blu-ray.
Okay. So I watched it on HBO Max because my DVD copy, which is in the Mars tin, I don't know if you remember when this came out on DVD, here in the States, Seiko, they put out, it came in a round tin that looked like Mars.
Nice.
It's up in a closet somewhere in my box of DVDs. So I watched it on HBO Max as well.
Now, being a few years older than me, You guys might have noticed, you know, the prosthetics, the fake, you know, the heads and stuff during the fat girl airport transformation, and when he's yanking a thing out of his nose. But when I was a kid, all of that looked so real to me. You know, I didn't know that that was a fake Arnold head that came out of that lady's body. You know,
it still holds up. I mean,
it does.
Sure. If you really scrutinize it, sure, you know, it's animatronics or it's puppetry or it's special effects or what have you. But this movie does such a good job at balancing suspension of disbelief, because it brings you from point A to B to C to D. There's a logical progression, and they introduce a concept before it becomes a story element. Like, for example, when you walk through an X-ray machine, they show Arnold walking through an X-ray machine mm-hmm. as an everyday thing. And later on in the movie, it becomes an actual plot point. It becomes an important element of his escape.
Yeah. The one thing about that scene, though, with the woman checking, going through customs in Mars, is it's always bothered me when that like steel rod comes out and goes back in. That would have hit Arnold in the head.
Yeah. Yeah, that was deep.
And also how he didn't rip his nostrils open, taking that tracker out.
Oh, my. That had to hurt.
You know, I wanted to ask you guys, we never see that guy again, right? The guy that. The guy in the briefcase that, nope. You know, says,
one and done.
Yeah. It's, we have to assume that he
planted by Cohagen
or planted by Hauser.
Yeah. Depending on which version you believe.
Same thing. Yeah. Well, so here's the thing. This entire movie is basically a plot to assassinate the head of the revolution in Mars. Mm-hmm. So this poor guy, who's dumped on Mars with a fake wife, if you follow this version of the story, is basically living with suppressed memories. He's obviously a lot smarter than the construction worker he appears to be. I found it interesting how much money they had. I mean, how much money would a construction worker have to have like an apartment like that, to have a wife looking like that? I mean, that's a trophy wife, because she was living at home.
Yeah.
And she was happy. Oh. How do you keep her happy like that? I mean, she's playing fake tennis all day, right?
Yeah. That job was an OSHA's nightmare. Arnold is jackhammering there. No protective gear anywhere in sight. Oh. I don't know how he didn't have like extreme hearing loss at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you get to Seiko, where there's the scene where Michael Ironside, who's like one of the all-time great henchmen, has that scene where he says to the other guy, when they established that, you know, Sharon Stone was undercover as Quaid's wife, says, you think she liked it?
No, I'm sure she hated every minute of it. Yeah. That's like the most Paul Verhoeven scene you can make. That look the actor gives, that's typical, typical Paul Verhoeven.
And you see like that seed of insecurity sort of, you know, fester inside of Ironside. And
He wants to kill Arnold.
I feel like, too, any other actor that or any other character that delivers that line would get a bullet right between the eyes. But this guy could get away with it.
Oh, yeah. Because Richter, Michael Ironside plays a character named Richter, and Richter mm-hmm. is
a sociopath. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, this guy was going to was fucking up the works, because mm-hmm. Cohagen, the main bad guy of the movie, had this big, elaborate, intelligent plan. And at some point he thought, you know what? I'm going to put Richter on it, because he's the right guy for the job. Well, guess what, buddy? He wasn't.
No.
Oh, my God. What a mess did this guy make.
Maybe. But he didn't give him all the information. It was just like, bring Hauser or bring Quaid back to me. And he didn't tell him anything else.
But at the same time, did Cohagen know that he had a relationship with the Sharon Stone character? Because why would you do that? Why would you take your main henchman's woman and put her undercover for, I mean, how long do they think he was going to be undercover for?
No idea. But basically it was a timed memory cap that was going to be popped at a specific time.
So once the revolution was squashed.
Right. So they could pop his memory cap so Hauser or Quaid could return to Mars so they could capture Quado, blah, blah, blah. So that was the whatever plan they had, it malfunctioned because they had Richter and his wife was with Quaid, and this guy was just not happy. And when you think about it, if your wife is just banging some asset and you just sort of have to stand back and be cucked.
Yeah.
I mean, I can sort of understand how he becomes homicidal at that point, but he does go off, seriously go off the rails, because at some point Quaid is escaping in an underground train and he just unloads his machine gun indiscriminately, killing innocent bystanders. He just does not care.
Yeah.
He just does give zero fucks. He's going back to Mars anyway. Fuck those Earthlings. Beautiful.
Yeah. I do want to talk a little bit about Sharon Stone at this point, because I think, I was saying a lot of people, I don't think about her anymore. Like, they just know her as Sharon Stone, the celebrity. They don't really think about her as an actress or as an actor. And I think that this movie is a great example of that. I mean, Basic Instinct.
Brilliant and talented she is.
Exactly.
Yes.
And I think the way she plays this character is so great, because she's able to like turn on a dime and realize when it's time to start putting the charm on again and trying to sort of seduce Quaid again. But it's all an act, because you see how quickly she turns. And man, she loved kicking him in the balls.
Oh, yes. Oh, definitely. You could see the glee in her face. Yeah.
You know what, though? I wonder if that was a thing, because later in the movie, the Melina character, they talk about making her like, making her Hauser's wife. And she says, "I'll bust his balls."
Wouldn't be the first one.
Wouldn't be the first one. Arnold got hurt in this one. Definitely. Aside from hurting his hand, hitting a window that was supposed to pop, but it didn't. And Sharon Stone actually hurt him in the fight, and he had a broken finger. And they had to shoot around it for the rest of the shoot.
And Michael Ironside crack his sternum too.
Oh yeah, yeah.
He got really fucked up.
This is an action movie. This is an 80s action movie, and you pay the price.
Mm-hmm.
That's why those movies are so good, because the actors are in pain.
Yeah, and he had to do the elevator fight scene with Arnold with a broken sternum.
Ah. See you at the party, Richter.
That has to be one of the greatest all times diss and dismiss in a movie. Like, I mean,
the guy loses his arms.
Yeah, while he's holding his arms.
Falls to his death and his arms hit the ground seconds after he does. It's just savage. It's just a savage dismissal.
After him, the guy falls. He's like screaming. He sees like the end of his limbs, and he's like, ah, that's the end of him. And then he just throws his arms around. "See you at the party, Richter." It's beautiful.
That was, as a 12-year-old kid watching this, that was one of the more memorable death scenes I've ever seen.
You applaud at that point, because that's just brilliantly done.
But you know what? And this is classic Arnold too, because I know a lot of people sort of joke about, like, you know, you have these like corny sort of lines that characters say after they kill somebody, but that one was perfect. And it seemed like something that could potentially be said in reality, you know, like, it wasn't like a cheesy line. And I think Arnold.
Yeah, and it was a comeback too.
Yeah,
because Richter had punched him in the face right before he was going to be brainwashed. It's like, is he going to remember any of this? No. We'll see him later at the party. And he just punches him in the face and he leaves the room and like, "I'll see you at the party." Right? Well, it's like, that's your check, buddy.
He got him back.
Ah, this movie's just full of that stuff. Just like the one of my favorite things about the special effects was they introduced the watch he has where he can project
the hologram
hologram. And so at first he's like shooting at himself, and that's Verhoeven's way of explaining how that hologram works. So later on, when they're in a dire situation and they're surrounded by security forces, he uses that watch. And after 5 seconds of those guards shooting at him, you suddenly realize, oh, he's using the watch.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you see the life drain out of Richter's face too when he realizes he's not dead, because he was glowing when he thought, oh, we finally got this guy.
Now we got him.
Not to you know, nitpick, but in that scene, you had soldiers on both sides shooting at a hologram with with no crossfire deaths.
Yeah, that should have hurt.
The other thing I like about that scene too is how they share the watch, the hologram. So at some points it becomes Milena.
That's smart another use of a tactical advantage.
Yeah. Another great actress, Rachel Tickleton, who is just, I think she's great in this movie. And this might sound weird, but the one thing I really appreciated about this movie was, and I don't know if either one of you noticed it, but her teeth were real teeth.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't like super, super white.
She didn't have pretty caps.
Yeah. And I appreciated that because this is a resistance woman on Mars.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I mean,
we're lucky she's not a mutant with three tits. Right? I mean, let's face it. We're talking about this intellectual side of the movie and the action side of the movie. But when we were 12 years old and I was a little older, but when we were in our teens and we were watching this movie, Paul Verhoeven took us to the Amsterdam red light district on Mars, and you had like really hot women with completely deformed faces and women with three breasts and all kinds of insane stuff.
And a little person as well.
Oh yeah. Who's quite homicidal when she gets a knife in her hands. I mean, it's out there, this movie.
Yeah. 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 How great is that fight between Milena and Sharon Stone?
Normally, you would get a cat fight. Here, you just get like Bruce Lee. This is basically Bruce Lee against Chuck Norris. Rachel Ticotine's character is a revolutionary, so of course she's not gonna be scratching faces or pulling hair. She's gonna be kicking your teeth down your throat. It was an amazing fight to watch.
It really was. I love that fight. And then, of course, it's got the great consider this a divorce payoff.
Was that your wife? What a bitch.
You know, she's not your typical leading lady from the 80s either. And she was remotely just gorgeous, though. Her she just looked perfect.
Sleazy, sexy, and demure. Just like he specified when he was in the chair before he got implanted. So it could all be a dream.
Yeah.
And how about let's talk a little bit about Quado, the animatronic tumor.
I remember in the 90s it ended up in house songs where Open Your Mind would be repeated 50 times, because you know how that goes. You go to a party and everybody's on pills, so it's like open your mind.
Yeah.
Open your mind.
Yeah, and the way he says it is like it's mesmerizing.
I think it's like Paul Verhoeven's take on Yoda.
But you look at even the mouth of the animatronic, and when they did, you mentioned Yoda. When they did Yoda, it was just a puppet where the mouth went up and down.
Mm-hmm.
But Quado's mouth articulated the words "open your mind" over and over again. Mm-hmm. And like, what was it, like 15 puppeteers it took to operate him?
Yeah,
I believe
like,
it.
It really looks like he's pregnant with him.
Yeah.
I remember there was like this horror movie in the 80s. I think it was a trauma movie, which was, what was it called? Basket Case. The twin brother would be like attached, but hidden. It kind of like had that kind of horror movie-esque feel to it. And the irony is that was a low budget horror movie. And this is like a big budget Hollywood movie just showing like the most atrocious stuff. Because when you think, you don't expect this kind of thing. You're expecting, John Connor, a rebel leader. No, you're not getting that. You're getting like a baby inside of a man.
They explain the idea of the mutants being, unprotected from the sun's radiation.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine like it's not something that happened overnight. This is over the course of a couple of generations.
Yeah.
But each mutant had a different issue. You know, Benny's arm was different than the little prophet girl's face, and which was different than Tony's prosthetics.
Right.
You know,
what did he have? Like in the back of his head, looked like a vagina.
Yeah, yeah. What it was like that? A strip of those makeup people just to come up with these different little.
Rob Bottin, man, he's a wizard.
Yeah.
Man.
They just basically gave him free reign. It's like, hey man, go to town.
Tony got the short end of the stick though, but you know, you got the stripper with the three tits. Like her mutation wasn't as bad.
I think we haven't talked about the great, great Ronnie Cox yet.
No, we haven't. And we should.
Yeah.
He's one of my favorite Star Trek captains. From the episode Chain of Command, part one and part two. Get it done. None of that Picard shit.
The Ronnie Cox had this incredible ability as an actor to play a good guy, really great, like he did in Beverly Hills Cop, or play a bad guy, really great, like he did in RoboCop and Total Recall. And a lot of actors get sort of, they do one or the other. They're not able to excel at both. And Ronnie Cox is just such a next level guy that you could buy him as the captain in Beverly Hills Cop, and then also as, you know, Dick Jones or the
guy who plays the banjo in Deliverance. And I don't mean the kid on the bridge, the guy in the boat who starts playing with the kid. That's Ronnie Cox.
Oh,
he's been around that long.
Brilliant, brilliant actor. Brilliant and Cohagan.
True character actor.
Yeah. And Cohagan's great. And the one thing I love in this movie is you can tell that he had some kind of genuine friendship with Hauser. And when he finally has to make the decision to let Hauser go,
he's pissed.
Yeah. Ironside plays it great. Cox plays it great. It's just, it's not acting that you should see in a movie like Total Recall, but you get it. And it's awesome.
Yeah. And, like, it broke his heart to have to make that call.
Yeah.
Yeah. Verhoeven infused some extra layers into the relationship between Cohagan and Hauser that is not on screen. And I looked at the director's commentary, and that's Verhoeven talking with Arnold.
Yeah.
And so which Verhoeven is going, so well, you know, maybe there's something going on here. Maybe, maybe Cohagan had a sexual relationship with Hauser, and maybe that's why he can't let him go. And that's why he's so pissed. And that's why his goldfish has to die, because he kicks his aquarium. Yeah. Right. And so Arnold goes, no, it's just because they're best friends. And he wanted none of that. Right. But that's Verhoeven. He's a little,
I didn't think there was any way, but in the video clip where it shows Cohagan and Arnold, they are standing shoulder to shoulder. Is he as tall as Arnold is?
He looked taller than Arnold in that clip.
Yeah. And it might be because Cohagan is supposed to be kind of like a father figure to Hauser.
All right. So they probably put him on a,
They're in it together, and they're like two peas in a pod.
Yeah, that was the same set where they filmed the briefcase scene as well. Hauser looked exactly, it looked like the same day almost. Like they were like, okay, we're going to film the escape scene, and then we're going to film the Hauser reveal scene.
Yes, and then they're going to go into the brainwash room, and after that, we just dump you on Earth, and you get to fuck Richter's wife. That's probably what sold it to Hauser. It's like you like Laurie, right? Well, you get to fuck her all day.
What is your favorite tech in this movie? So there's a couple of different tech things that jumped out. There was, of course, the like the video phone. But then there was also the change your nail color on demand.
Oh, yeah. I love that.
The Johnny Cab.
Cab is my absolute favorite.
The great Robert Picardo doing
Cab.
And you could tell they sort of modeled the Johnny Cab after Picardo. If you look at him, he kind of looks like Robert Picardo.
Hell of a day, isn't it?
Some great tech in this
one
movie.
One thing that always struck me as really odd is I always thought it was like, okay, so is this standard that when you stiff the cab, you don't
for
pay
18 credits,
he tries to kill you?
What caused that?
Yeah, it doesn't seem like a great solution.
And it's like,
I also loved how there was a manual control for the Johnny Cab, but
yeah,
The Johnny Cab didn't use it because he didn't have arms.
But you would have to yank the mannequin out of the car to use it.
Well, or deactivate it in some way, and Arnold just didn't have any patience, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's like, go, just go, and the cat just won't refuse it. Or, I don't recognize that. That's the name, Arnold. Brilliant. Okay, so we talked a little bit about Sharon Stone. I don't think we've talked enough about Sharon Stone because she's at her absolute hottest in this movie. I mean, I've seen her before and stuff. I mean, you remember like Alan Quatermain and she's also in Action Jackson with Carl Weathers. And that's a really good movie that I think I'm going to cover it for as a special episode for the network at some point.
There's a scene in Action Jackson that even bothered me when I was a kid is he punches through the windshield and it breaks like glass.
Oh, I mean, almost like it's like made of sugar.
Well, no, but I mean, like, we all know that like a windshield will spider.
Right.
You know, this is like he's like punching through the glass on a front window or something of somebody's house. That always bothered me. And also Action Jackson has the insanely beautiful Vanity as well.
Oh, yeah. Carl Weathers' wife.
Yeah. You know, a pretty tragic story with Vanity, but capture that moment in time. And I mean, that just what a vibrant personality and
what a smoking hot woman.
Yeah. And and talented too.
Yeah. So here we have Sharon Stone and here we have Paul Verhoeven looking at Sharon Stone, seeing what she can do, obviously already having the Basic Instinct script and having this in the back of his mind. It's like, can she can do this for 5 minutes, but could she do this for 2 hours?
It was almost like an audition.
Everybody wanted to be in Basic Instinct. Everybody. Really? And Paul Verhoeven just raised the bar to a point where he had like this really nasty script full of sexual stuff. And that you'd have like these famous actresses, like you named them and they read. And they would be like, yeah, but it's not going to be as bad as in the script, right? And Paul Verhoeven just said, oh, no, it would be much worse. And of course, they'd seen Paul Verhoeven's Dutch stuff. So if you've seen his Dutch stuff, you know it's much worse.
Now, he wanted her to show a little bit more skin in this than she was willing to do. And when he got her to do Basic Instinct, it was, you know, him showing her, I guess.
The famous, I didn't know about this stuff. Of course, she knew about it. She had to sign it. She had to sign for that. Everybody was kicked off the set to do that scene. She had to take her panties off. According to Carl Paul Verhoeven, she gifted him her panties. She's a liar.
You don't know what to believe because in The Specialist, was it The Specialist? Yeah. She took a bottle of tequila for her to agree to get naked on that or a bottle of vodka.
According to Stallone, but Stallone is a liar too.
I don't know what to believe.
Because I remember this interview where they talked about that sex scene and you see a lot of Stallone and very little Sharon Stone. And
the reason
Stallone gave was, I kept warning Sharon that, you know, you can't eat all that pizza because we're going to have this scene. And so he kept training and she kept eating pizza. And in the end, she sort of hid behind him.
Yeah, we talked about how unsettling that scene is, Craig.
Yeah. Scott Murphy just a review on The Specialist that in it they talk at length about how horribly awkward the humping is in the shower scene.
Yeah,
I have to agree with him. It's hard to watch, and it's not really Sharon Stone's best stuff. And when you look at this movie, when she's in bed with Arnold and she's like, you know, loosening her bodice, and well, guess what? They practiced that in a hotel room. The three of them went to the Marriott Hotel, got a room. And they practice that scene, which is typical Arnold, because Arnold always ultra rehearses every scene he does because he's a very, well, let's face it, he's insecure about his acting. Here's a guy who came from bodybuilding, didn't know anything about acting, really. He could barely deliver lines. So this is a guy who had to practice and practice and practice at his craft. So he would rehearse every scene of the script. And so this is a script he loved. So he knew the script by heart. So at some point they said, well, I don't do that many sex scenes. We should probably rehearse this. So they went to the Marriott They frolicked in the hotel room, and lo and behold, the paparazzi got a hold of it. And so ever since then, they've been suggesting, well, they had a threesome. And so,
of course,
I'm from, you know, European sensibilities, and there's sex in every movie, and there's breasts in every movie, and there's nudity in every movie. It's normal. So we don't really think about it. It's like brushing teeth for us. But I assume for an American audience, seeing this much skin, that must have been shocking. And having hotel employees seeing Sharon Stone coming and seeing like this big muscular guy Arnold show up, and oh, that isn't that Paul Verhoeven? And we've heard about this guy. So well, that's there. The reputation just went out the window there.
You never know behind closed doors.
On the other hand, this is, of course, if you go with the idea of Total Recall, and there could be two stories in every situation, they could have known, well, everybody's just going to automatically assume there's something weird going on here. Hey, let's do something weird. Could have been that. It is Hollywood we're talking about. Mm-hmm. They could have been doing unsavory things in that hotel room instead of rehearsing. You never know.
I have a, not to derail this saucy talk with plot stuff, but I have a question about the plot real quick.
Okay.
This
movie does have a plot. That's true.
Because at some point, Richter says, you know, at any moment he can have total recall. So the memory that they implanted in him, that was good. That had like an expiration date on it.
I think they could trigger it
in some way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or that they hadn't completely erased all of the Hauser memories. Mm. So normally you'd think that they would clear the memory to make room for the implanted memory. So I think here it was sort of sitting on top of the old memories. So it's a matter of the old memories finally, you know,
coming back to the surface,
breaking through. Yeah.
And they were obviously insecure about it because they were watching him like a hawk. I mean, they had the wife, they had the colleague, the minister. For some reason, all these people were all working independently from each other, because this colleague, this coworker from the construction yard, heard something weird, and went and got his buddies, and they tried to execute him. Like, hey, you blabbed about Mars, and now we're gonna like put you up against the wall and kill you.
Yeah, I almost wonder if they were working or they were sort of dispatched through Richter, who was just looking for an excuse. Absolutely brilliant and brutal scene there where Arnold dispatches, is it five guys?
Yeah.
In that alleyway almost. And the final shot you see there with the dead bodies and Arnold standing there with the gun, that looks like a postcard if you pause the movie. It's just the composition of that shot. And the thing I love about Arnold's performance in that sequence is he effectively does all of this really physical, technical, you know, obviously he's been trained in combat, but as soon as it's over, he's shocked that he was able to do it.
Right.
And,
he's still a human being.
Yeah. Right. Uh-huh. And I think like, if you really wanted to pinpoint amazing moments in Arnold's acting career that showcase that he does have the ability when he's led there. Mm-hmm. That's definitely a sequence where that, you know, that shines through.
Definitely. Yes. And I mean, let's face it, this entire chase of Quaid is one big action packed bloody affair.
You have the guy in the escalator. Just
this to like the shock of this Quaid character realizing he's someone else and there's something very strange going on, or he's going through some kind of psychotic episode. I mean, this is all very confusing, and it's something you can read off his face. And that's not your typical action hero. That's someone trying to act and succeeding at it. In this four-part season, we've been talking about Arnold becoming an action hero, Arnold chasing Stallone. Now you see Arnold at his peak. You see Arnold at his absolute best. Here's a guy who moved and shaked to have this movie become a reality. He's in the position he wants to be in. This is his big moment. And he steps up to the plate and he delivers, because this is a great performance. And this is peak Arnold. That's one of the reasons I think why Arnold loves this movie, and his autobiography is called Total Recall. Hint, this movie really propelled him. This made 90s Arnold.
Perfectly put, Seiko. I mean, it really is. And I hadn't really thought about the overall impact on Arnold's career that this movie had, because he could have very easily, you know, gotten trapped in the franchise sort of loop that Stallone found himself in. Mm-hmm.
He's the guy who said no to Stop or My Mom Will Shoot.
And then psychologically tricked Stallone into doing it. Kind of like when he psychologically screwed with Lou Ferrigno in Pumping Iron.
Exactly. He knew he was on top. And once Arnold is on top, there's no way you're ever going to get him away from there. He knows exactly what to do to stay up there. And he knows Stallone's finished.
Craig, that's why Siegel likes Arnold so much, is because he's as big a troll as he is.
Exactly.
You were in the middle of making a point.
No, I was just curious. I mean, do you have the box office numbers for this, Siegel?
Sure. This movie cost $65 million to make. About 20% of that went to the special effects, and the rest of it went to, actors and sets and a 500 head crew. In Mexico, box office, we're talking 261 million in 2000 theaters.
So that's the domestic. It did over 200 million in domestically?
Yes.
That's amazing. And for a little perspective, the first Jurassic Park in 1993 had about a $65 million budget.
Yeah.
So just look at the bang for your buck with Total Recall and the return on investment there. So worldwide, it did much more. I didn't realize
close to half a billion,
big as
which
a hit
was
as
a lot of money
was
for that time.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
This is like modern day Marvel movie money.
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah. Blowing everyone else out of the water.
Yes, yeah. You know what? That's pretty crazy. Like I said, I never really sort of took any time to sort of evaluate like where this sort of sat in the overall career path.
Yes, and Arnold was looking for a hit. Arnold was looking for something that would really move the numbers, because at some point when the movie was done, he was savvy enough to realize we're not getting enough traction. We're this trailer we have sucks. At some point, they had like 40% awareness. So he actually pressured TriStar into hiring another publicity company to redo the trailer. Then he started really looking at, you know, the tracking numbers, and it actually went up to 92% awareness. So this was an actor at the top of his game, at the point where he can just pick his projects, and he was just not going to let this project fail, as other projects he had masterminded had, you know, disappointed him, because Red Heat wasn't the hit he was looking for. Running Man ran into all kinds of problems. So it was not going to happen again.
Which is crazy, considering that, like, I mean, he doesn't have a background in marketing or anything like that, but he knew what it took to put this in as many theaters and in front of as many people as it needed to be. And, you know, yeah. I mean, imagine if he didn't pressure the studio to hire somebody else to, you know, to spread the word.
Yeah, but he got certain scenes back into the movie. At some point, you have this scene where you see a train going into the mountain in Mars, and the studio said, look, we don't need that shot, it's really expensive. And so Paul Verhoeven was talking this over with Arnold and said, look, I really want to do this shot. So Arnold just said, look, I'm just going to make this happen. And he went to the production and said, look, we need this shot, and it just happened. And Verhoeven said, look, that shot, and this specific shot in this part of the movie, would never be in it. And it's really important. And it would never be in there unless you said something. Now that's saying something. And I think Arnold at this point saw making a movie like building his body. He was thinking in terms of, how do I flex this muscle? Right. How do I make this bigger? Yeah, this was his Olympia.
He was committed.
He was, 100%. And this was a guy who stands back and watches other people work, understands how they do their stuff, then just takes over. Mm-hmm. That's how he thinks. That's how he works. That's why it takes a while for him to get the gist of things. Once he does, there's no way you're ever going to beat him.
The other thing I think that's interesting about Arnold, and I don't want to make this like a Sly versus Arnold thing, because I love them both. I devoted a whole podcast to Stallone, but Stallone tended to find situations where he could get people that were just talented enough to do the job, but didn't have enough of an ego so he could push them around. Mm-hmm. Whereas on here, Arnold coexisted with Paul Verhoeven, which
Arnold thrived with Paul Verhoeven.
Yeah. Whereas in 1990, I do not see Stallone working with somebody as powerful as Verhoeven. You know, for comparison, he's working with like first time or second time directors like Rennie Harlan on a movie like Cliffhanger, where you can sort of control the set, and it's incredibly commendable to think that Arnold had enough confidence in himself, but also was able to sort of disconnect his ego just enough to let somebody like Verhoeven in. And I don't know if maybe, and I might've just answered my own question here, guys, maybe it's that early experience working with James Cameron. He saw the benefit of working with very, very powerful directors, because
I think Arnold knew his limitations and realized, I just need a great director. I need to be directed well. I mean, he did Twins with Ivan Reitman. Of course, Ivan Reitman is a comedic genius. And Twins worked, really worked because of that. And
well, Twins also worked because of Kelly Preston.
And Kelly Preston, absolutely. Total Recall, it's set in 2084. Which isn't that far away when you think about it. So it's nice to think about, you know, us having interstellar travel. So maybe Elon Musk will get his act together, maybe even based on this movie. You never know.
And the Sony Trinitron brand will be coming back.
Oh, yeah. Isn't that great? Because I'm really looking forward to having like a wall TV screen where I can just project a lake and watch the news at the same time.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, this movie predicted flat screens in 1990.
Yeah.
So one thing that bothers me a little bit, and so here we are in the science fiction cleanup, and I'm kind of a geek, so I have to do this. Turbinian is nonsense. The mineral does not exist. Yeah. This is a plot device, people. Live with it. There's another problem. This turbinium, when it's heated, you see this big alien machine. Okay, so it melts, and then pure oxygen is released into the Martian atmosphere. And this is supposed to save Arnold from exposure to Martian space. It doesn't work because air to be breathable has to be, and I checked this, 78% nitrogen, 21% oxygen, not 100%, 21%, and 1% various gases. So if you release 100% oxygen, and I'm a hobby diver, so I need to know a little bit about oxygen. If you release that into the air, it's kind of volatile.
I know you're going down a science path here, but would that air eventually disappear as well? Because didn't they say also on the glaciers melting?
Yeah, there's no water.
So they're gonna be in trouble again eventually.
There's no
viable terraforming happening there. This is all, I don't know, maybe Quaid can run for office after this because he released air and become the second Cohagen, and then he just has to put people back into domes again.
It wouldn't instantly turn a red sky blue and, you know, have a similar atmosphere to Earth.
Yeah. Although the stuff you see at the beginning of the movie and at the end where Arnold is exposed to Martian air, when you see his eyes bug out and you see his skin is like that's realistic.
Swelling.
If you are caught out in the open on Mars, basically your organs are just going to ooze out of your asshole. Your brain is like going to leak out of your ears.
All the liquid in your body will boil or expand. Right?
Yes. It'll just come oozing out everywhere because of the atmospheric difference. So that's fun. That's I also get, to think about.
I also get that Mars is considered the red planet, but they really, really leaned into the redness of Mars.
What did they know? There was 1990. There were, yeah, I mean, there was, yeah, no Hubble telescope, and there was no, I know, you Mars see the rover. That was all later.
Right. The rover pictures nowadays, it just looks like a hazy day, you know? Right?
But at the end of the movie, once the atmosphere is released, it's not as red. It just looks more like a deserty.
Mm. Yeah. Just yeah, like in
blue sky.
Just like in The Office at Recall. It's like the exact same picture. What do you know? Oh, they're doing Alien Artifacts now.
Mm-hmm. Well, and talking about the Recall office, and you mentioned earlier that you can sort of take from this movie what you want, but at the end when she says, so, you know, kiss me before you know, if it's a dream, kiss me before you wake up. And then you sort of get that flare, like that, the light sort of engulfing them. And there's all kinds of ways you can take that. And if you're of the opinion that this is all a Recall thing, that's the moment where he finally goes into a schizoid embolism or whatever. And
yeah, that's where they drill into his brain.
Becomes lobotomized.
Where he's fully lobotomized. I mean, yeah. Or you can just say, okay, these are the characters riding off into the sunset. Mm-hmm. The more I watch this, guys, I used to be 100% team. This is all real. But the more I watch it and the more breadcrumbs I see Verhoeven leaving and the screenwriters leaving, I have to believe that this is all just in his head, and there's not a happy ending for Quaid.
So here we are. We're at the end of our season. And don't worry, we'll be back, because next season we have lots of Arnold stuff in store for you. But we're going to be taking a small break. We're hoping at one point we can entice Craig back. What do you say, Craig?
I say yes. And you said you're only talking good Arnold movies, and I want to make sure we're all on the same page here.
Okay.
Does that include Raw Deal?
Maybe.
I don't think we had that initially.
Not initially. I think it's planned way, way, way down the line. I do enjoy Raw Deal. We've talked about it on a previous episode. I do enjoy Raw Deal, but I think it was wasn't that with Sean on the Conan episode? Anyway, Sean said it was like the most disjointed thing he's ever seen.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, it's Arnold doing a favor for Dino De Laurentiis. That's basically it. But it works on a very, really weird level. And I think it's quintessential Arnold in the mid-80s. So
next season we have, what do we got? Predator and Running Man.
Oh, yeah. Oof.
Yeah.
Either way, guys, I can – one of the things that I pride myself on is being able to derail any conversation of any movie. So
Price whenever you,
very true, very true.
Whenever you guys want me, I'm there, and I look forward to it. And again, if you're listening to this and you haven't seen Total Recall in a while, and you think that we're overreacting or it's just a huge love fest, this movie seriously delivers. It's really, I mean, we nitpicked a little bit, but it really is, from a construction standpoint, about as perfect and tight of a script that you can get.
It's barely nitpickable.
Mm-hmm.
Doug, yeah. Any parting thoughts, both on this movie and our season?
I think this was a great, wrap up to this season. You know, we started with Arnold's origins in Pumping Iron, and we got to really what I think we all consider his peak action performances of, you know, not that, yeah, man, I can't even say he just, you know, dropped off after this, because he was still working. But this is undoubtedly the peak. And I think we wrapped it up nicely. One of the things I love about what we do here is we don't, and no offense to the guys that do like plot heavy films, because I do it with Rocky Minute. Mm-hmm. You know, but we get more into the background and the nuances, and, you know, we of course we touch on the plot, but it's not, we don't go beat by beat through the plot. So it's not, you know, so people that listen and they still want to watch the movie are still going to be surprised, but they're also going to have these nuggets in the back of their mind saying, oh, that's what they were talking about, you know? So
yes, because I think going beat by beat with this movie is impossible. Well, yeah. You could do it, but you wouldn't do it justice, because you have to do it twice.
You could do a 6-part series like the 6 DOS guys do on, and I hope they do this. Mm-hmm. Unless they did, they didn't do this one yet, right?
I think they've done it, but just haven't released it yet. I think they just released a whole Terminator series, and they've just released a whole Eraser series. They're really good at doing play by play.
Yes,
I really enjoy listening to them in terms of going from one part of the movie to the next.
Yeah.
They tied it up well.
But shit, I mean, you could do 6 parts on just the duality of this movie, is whether it's real or if it's in Quaid's mind.
I get a lot of shit about being critical about Stallone. Mm-hmm. But if you start listening to the 6 Degrees of Schwarzenegger, they take Stallone critique to the next level. So,
one thing you did say, Doug, and I don't want to get us into a whole other conversation here, but you sort of said this was sort of the crest of the mountain, if you will. Mm-hmm. I think that also dovetails into a conversation about this was all leading to an end at some point for the ultra, hyper, action genre that was peak Stallone and peak Schwarzenegger, and Seagal sort of got into that and got some of that money at some point, but nobody realized it, of course, because you never realize when something's going to end, or you don't hope it's going to end. But we all knew there was a point, or looking back now, you see that there's a point where they've gone as high as they can in terms of salaries and budgets and everything. That
this was a crescendo.
Yeah, exactly, and the logical conclusion happened, right?
Yes, like, and it couldn't be any other guy. It was always going to be Arnold.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so a great ending to the season.
A great ending to the season. Thank you, listeners, so much for listening. We hope to see you back next season. We hope to see Craig back next season. Bye for now.